Hello, everyone. It's a good late night for me right now, and I apologize to those of you who were waiting for the live show and it was delayed. Something came up at my office and I had to deal with it. So I apologize for that. And I'm joined by Aisha, who is in Australia. Aisha, how's it going?
Hi, I'm good, Abdullah. How are you?
Good, good, good. So we're on opposite sides of the planet. We're joined by only one thing, which is that we're both ex-Muslim. Imagine that. Were you born in Australia?
I wasn't. So I was born in South Africa and I grew up in New Zealand. So I spent most of my childhood there. And then when I was about 12, 13 years old, we moved to Australia. And so I've spent most of my life living here now.
Oh, nice, nice. So you're just waking up, I'm going to bed. Imagine that, right? The internet has made this possible and it's quite amazing.
It is.
What a long way we've come, you know, we meaning ex-Muslims. I remember when I first started this 5 years ago, I mean, there was barely a few voices, Hassan Radwan, Sarah Haider, Mohammed Syed. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them have actually moved into the background. They're doing things behind the scenes. They're working on, you know, EXM&A. The persecution tracker, which they just announced, which is amazing.
So amazing.
New people have stepped up to the plate now and are coming out and talking about these things.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think as well, because in our age, obviously, we've grown up with the internet. Now, when a lot of, you know, boomers and Gen X, when they were all growing up, so, for example, like Yasmin Muhammad, they didn't have access to the same technologies and platforms that we do now. So it's a really great privilege that we have in this younger generation to be able to connect with each other in the ways that we have. So it's awesome.
Absolutely. And it's safe, right? I mean, one of the main factors behind what I do is not because I'm some super brave, amazing gem of a human. It's because I'm safe in Canada. And mm-hmm. consequences to my life are there still, but the somewhat limited. And you know, even for you to do this, you know, to come out and to talk about these things, there is some, you know, worry, right? Because, and mm-hmm. can we talk about that a little bit? Like, what are the risks of an ex-Muslim coming out and talking about Islam, even in the West?
I mean, obviously, you know, in the West, we have so much advantage when it comes to coming out as ex-Muslim. It's not in our legislation that we're going to be killed if we go ahead and do that. So we're very lucky in that sense. But still, again, coming back to Yasmin Muhammad as an example, she grew up in Canada as well, and yet she still ended up in the situation that she was in, married to an Al-Qaeda terrorist. It was awful. So I think there is some misconception that for ex-Muslims that grew up in Western countries, that, you know, that there can't be any risks because we don't have a government that is out to get us or anything like that. But the thing is, in a Western country, I think quite often it can be a lot more subtle, the stuff that goes on to ex-Muslims and the risks that we go through, because it is often kept behind doors. Behind closed doors, Muslim families are very tight-knit about what's going on. And so I don't think that negates the fact that we are still exposed to risks like abuse from family, ostracization from the community, all that kind of stuff is still there. And then look at Apostate Prophet. You know, he lives in a Western country and he's still getting an arrest warrant from Turkey. So it's certainly a global issue at this point.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is true as well. What I was trying to kind of say is that at least we don't have implicit government support for us, you know, being blasphemers. And, you know, like in a country like Morocco, even if blasphemy is not on the law books, you still have a situation where the government, the police, they look aside. And Morocco actually probably has blasphemy law, but like I'm saying, even in a Muslim country where it's not an official law, in fact, even Sri Lanka, where you have like 10% Muslim population, some 5%, I was talking to a man there, an ex-Muslim fellow, and he was saying that even there, the police, you know, they don't care about these things. They look away. And my friend in Morocco, he was saying that when he went to the police, he couldn't tell them that they're attacking me because I offended the religious sensibilities, because the police system will actually arrest you and they'll throw you in jail and they'll say, well, you shouldn't be attacking Islam. So we have that benefit that we have the law on our side here, that we're not breaking any laws. But like you said, there's always a risk to family violence, especially as a woman, right? You know, many ex-Muslim women, including the young lady I spoke to earlier, little devil, as she calls herself, Sophia, she was strangled or, you know, almost murdered by her dad for going against Islam. And so a lot of these people, they come from, you know, different countries, and they bring this like misogyny with them, this you know, this sort of like total control they want, even though it's, you know, not allowed under Islam to kill your daughter like that. I mean, the Quran says those who bury their daughters alive will be asked and questioned about it. But it's just, you know, Islam, it perverted and it, you know, twisted the guy's brain to the point where the father thought, if it's better I strangle her and she becomes a Muslimah, although of course that's so stupid, that doesn't work. But in his brain, he thinks, you know, physical violence can actually change her behavior. But it'll only change the behavior on the outside. On the inside, she's still going to have the same, like, weak iman or no iman, right? Maybe a iman. In fact, that was what caused her to leave. So you're definitely, you know, that point is valid that, yes, there's a lot of risk to ex-Muslims. And I don't want to downplay that at all. But I was just saying that, yeah, from the at least we have the law on our side, you know?
Absolutely.
So do you want to talk about, let's go to you know, let's go back to how it started for you. What opened your eyes to the fact that Islam may not be what you were told? Because you grew up in a Muslim family, you were taught to be a Muslim from a young age. What changed? What made you you know, rebel against your parents, rebel and go against the grain, and not just that, but also come out publicly? What was it about Islam that bothered you and caused you first to leave it and then to want to talk about it?
It was very much, I think, a slow drip, my journey out of Islam. It wasn't some big explosive escape, you know, from a Muslim country like some of the stories that you hear, particularly on the news and stuff like that. It was very much a gradual, slow burn for me. I think from a young age, I did always sort of have a side of me that was quite critical, and that would ask difficult questions of my parents about Islam, like, why did Prophet Muhammad marry a girl so young? Is that acceptable? Is that okay? What does that mean for us now in the 21st century? And it was those responses that I would get from my parents, like, oh, but that happened a long time ago, and so it was contextually appropriate back then. And then that just raises more issues. Well, okay, does that mean that homosexuality is now contextually appropriate in this day and age? It was just this spiral of ongoing things that didn't make sense to me. But then there was also the other side of me that was so heavily indoctrinated that I felt that, you know, Shaitan must be possessing me and making me think all these things and have all these questions. And so it was very much an internal struggle between I'm doubting and I want to ask questions, and then, oh, but I'm this horrible person and I need to get back into being super religious, otherwise, you know, burn in hell forever and all that kind of stuff. I think in my teenage years, especially because I was lucky enough, you know, again, to grow up in a Western country, and so I was exposed to a lot of stuff that made me think and made me question outside that realm of my family. So, for example, there was an incident when I was a teenager, and my mom and I had gotten into this huge argument about wearing t-shirts, like I'm wearing a t-shirt right now, and it was, you know, you're going to burn and you're going to be punished and all this horrible stuff is going to happen to you because you showed the skin on your arm that Allah apparently gave me, but whatever. And so I had friends who would reflect back to me, you know, I would tell them this stuff and they would say, but why would a God care if you're showing the skin of your arm? That's a very strange thing to condemn someone to hell for. And so it was stuff like that that would make me think, you know, okay, well, maybe that doesn't really make sense. So it was very much the moral side of things that led me to go down that path. The thing that tipped me over the edge, I guess you could say, is when I decided to knuckle down, study Islam, find out what there was to know, because I wanted to convince myself that Islam was true and that I should believe in it. And so I started to get into reading Quran, reading Hadith, asking questions, thinking that it was going to convince me, you know. And then, as has happened for a lot of Muslims/ex-Muslims now, that's the path that actually led us to disbelieve, because you start to realize things don't make sense. Things don't add up. It's just, it gets to a point where you can no longer tell yourself that this is the truth when it is so obvious that it isn't. Apostate prophet Ridwan, he played a big part in that for me as well. I was quite, I think I really connected with the way he uses humor in his videos. So even though I was young, it was that thing that made him stand out. And then I started watching his videos, finding everyone else out there on the internet. And yeah, it just kind of spiraled from there, I think.
Wow. Yeah, the common theme I find is people that are more practical, I mean, not practical, sorry. People, you know, both young men and young women who think logically and who have this sort of, you know, the brain, the way the brain works is they want to make sense of things. So they're not blind followers, blind believers, but the people that, like, I had one guy that was not exactly a friend of mine, but a Muslim guy that was writing about me. And he was like, yeah, this guy did computer science. And it was obvious that he was going to find problems with Salafism. So he was saying, oh, it's a Salafi problem, not an Islam problem. But of course, the problems are much deeper than Salafism. But it's that rational thinking. It's the, you know, the trying to make sense of the world and make it cohere. Because when you have doubts, you have this like questions going on in your head. Things are not clicking together. In your case, it was a morality. In my case, it was a science. But the interesting thing is Muslims all over the world have doubts of some sort or another. And it's just the ones that are willing to be brave and to actually face those doubts, those are the ones that are actually able to find the way out of Islam. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And you know what, Abdullah? It is so scary. It is so scary to ask yourself that first question, you know, could this be untrue? Could I have believed an entire fallacy my entire life, and now I have to reassess everything I've ever believed and go ahead and start this new understanding of the world? And that's that, like you said, that takes bravery, it takes courage, it is so difficult. Even if you narrow it down to the science, you know, what it actually means to be an ex-Muslim from the point of view of your brain, you're rewriting all these neural pathways that have been strengthened and conditioned throughout your entire life, and now you've got to take it all apart and put it back together again. It's so hard.
And it's extra hard when those neural pathways were written and almost like hardwired from like childhood.
Absolutely, because when you're born into Islam, the choice to believe isn't a choice. It was that was made up before you were conceived, probably. You know, like
acknowledge here. You were saying we're all born Muslim. It was written from when, before the Day of Judgment, Allah decreed that all of us will be Muslims. Alhamdulillah. Just a shout out to P. Thank you for the donation. Here's my weekly tax to Abdullah Samir. Likes and subscribers if you bought him. Thank you, Aisha, for coming and sharing. Thank you, P. We all, you know, I think that's a major part of it. People sometimes, you know, sometimes I hear Muslims say things like, well, if Islam wasn't true, then why are so many people Muslim? And they don't realize that, you know, the biggest thing that stops people from leaving Islam is this childhood indoctrination. Mm. And we've evolved to trust our parents and to, you know, believe them. And, you know, of course, in most cases, what they're telling us is for our best interest. But of course, sometimes they're wrong, right? And we do need to challenge them. We do need to go against what they're saying. How was that for you, going against your parents? Like you already mentioned a bit about you got into a bit of a conflict about the teachings, the modesty law of Islam, where you have to, as a woman, you have to be extra covered, more than a man would have to be covered. You got into a conflict about that with your mom. And then you were wondering, like, you know, why would the infinite creator of the universe and all of the stars and atoms and galaxies care about whether I cover my arms? And, you know, one of my friends says it, whether we, you know, cut off a foreskin. Like, it's so silly. Like, so what happened? Like, so what happened with your family, if you can talk about it? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. The journey with my family is still very fresh, I think, because I only came out officially as ex-Muslim this year. So it's very much walking on eggshells at the moment. But in terms of when I was growing up, my family were very much aware of the fact that I was quite outspoken and that I would say and ask things that really weren't appropriate. If I wanted to know and I was curious, I would just put it out there. And so I'm not sure, it's very difficult to gauge how much of a shock it was to my parents to learn that this is the path I've decided to go down, because contact did stop, you know, unsurprisingly, when they became aware of my decision to leave Islam. I'm very lucky in that I have a Muslim sister who I have a great relationship with. She doesn't, you know, she accepts me for who I am. We agree not to talk about religion because it always ends in an argument, but we can still love each other and have a relationship, you know, having these differences in beliefs. But it's hard with parents because, again, they're older and they've come from this totally different generation, this different life. My parents grew up during the apartheid era as well, so there's so much going on. And I know that, you know, religion is something for them that maybe gave them a sense of hope or something to hold on to in their lives. And I respect that, you know, they're entitled to do that, just like you and I are entitled to not believe. But it is very difficult living so close in proximity to my parents in the same city and being considered not their daughter anymore. It's, you know, what if I run into them at the grocery store? Like, it's very awkward.
What do you mean by not your daughter anymore?
So especially my dad, not so much my mom. She kind of is in and out of the idea of, you know, when your child leaves Islam, you must disown them. My dad is very clear cut in that it's, you know, Allah has decreed that that is what we do. We do not keep our children if they leave Islam. It's like the worst possible thing you can do in your life. My mum is, she flips in and out of that mindset, I think. But being a mother, I think that makes it easier for her to hold on to that connection, that maternal instinct towards me that keeps bringing her back. So every now and then I'll get a WhatsApp message from her that tells me it's like the anniversary of when Muhammad flew to heaven on the horse or whatever. And I'm like, okay, cool. But aside from those little messages here and there, we don't have a lot of contact right now. But I think it's, you know, it's a starting point.
Yeah, absolutely. I was lucky myself. And now, you know, just to kind of reflect on this a bit, I remember once I was a Muslim. And as you know, I converted from Ismailism to Sunnism. So I was an outsider to everything, right? In a sense, like I didn't grow up doing these things. And I was in the masjid for tafsir class. There was this fun little tafsir thing they used to do every Friday at the mosque, and they would give out food after. So that was an incentive. That was a bribe, right? And it was kind of fun. It was Desi masjid. And there was one guy sitting next to me. And I don't know how it came up. And he said, "I'm atheist." I was like, "What?
Wow.
What are you doing here?" I was a kid, right? I'm like, "What are you doing here in the masjid?" He's like, "My dad forces me to come." And I told him I'm atheist. He said, "If you say that again, I'm going to kick you out of the house." And I was like, at the time as a Muslim, I was like, that's the stupidest thing to do as a parent. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't do that. If my kid was having doubts about Islam, I would be super nice to them. And I would try to win back their love. I mean, the love is fine. But I mean, win back the iman.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand how, I just don't get that type of mentality that you cut off someone. Do you really think that's going to win them over and they're going to come back and say, "Oh, I love your religion that cut me off and treats me like shit"?
Mm-mm.
I don't know. Like, I don't get that. Maybe that's just a personality, an individual personality thing.
Maybe. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because some, like people like Zahra Kay, she has a fantastic relationship with her parents, and that's great. But then I feel that it's so much more common for parents to be cutting off their children when they come out as ex-Muslim. That's the narrative I'm often hearing from people. So it is interesting. It's very counterproductive. I don't know why they're doing it. It's not going to bring back anyone's iman. But, you know, it is what it is.
I would hope that these people, actually, I can't say the name, but I know another ex-Muslim that when he first left Islam, his family, his mom and dad, I don't know if, again, I think it was the dad more than the mom, was kind of like your dad. And over the years now, they talk on the phone regularly. They have a good relationship. Things have mended. He, you know, he has a kid, and his parents are now grandparents. So, you know, that's one way, become a parent and bribe your parents with, "Oh, look, here's a baby. Come hold my baby." And even in my case, like my mom and dad are from different sects. And when I was born, apparently my grandparents accepted that. I mean, that's just a personal thing anyways. But like, yeah, I feel your pain. And I feel like, you know, it's so unfortunate that this sort of mentality exists in the Muslim community. And like you said, it's probably more common because I'm probably just mirroring my own family experience. Because even I left Islam eventually and my parents were not like, they're fine. They're okay with it, right? So maybe because my parents are like that, I ended up like that too. But yeah, I think what you're saying is a more common experience, or at least, you know, the ones that have that experience, maybe they're more vocal about it. And again, there's always people that are not religious, but they don't really leave Islam. So they don't really have any backlash because there's just like I have cousins that like, they don't pray, they drink, they do everything. Mm-hmm. And the Muslims still, so there's no backlash from the parents, but like there's me and I'm ex-Muslim and there's you. And, you know, so you face a backlash because you told your parents you're not Muslim. Is that what you said to them?
The way that I came out was not the best way to go about it. I'll admit that now in hindsight. It basically happened after I'd watched an interview on YouTube with Sadia. I think her surname is Hamid. Sadia Hamid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was an Australian interview and the interviewer was just such an asshole. They brought this Muslim woman on and she like started crying and, you know, victimizing herself. It was just so frustrating to watch. And after that, I don't know why that was the catalyst, but I decided that I was going to use my Facebook to share my thoughts on that, to tell everyone, listen, I'm an ex-Muslim and I think this is bullshit. I lost so many friends, so many family members were coming forward and like sending screenshots of it to my parents. So it wasn't the best way to go about it, but sometimes it's just an explosive reaction and that's how it was for me, I guess.
Yeah, like I kind of did the same thing. I mean, I posted, unfortunately it caused problems too, because what happened was they started telling my brother to talk to me and he was like, he didn't even know about it, right? I don't know what's going on here. What is this, right? And then he emailed me and told me that like, people are bothering him. And I'm like, what are these cowards?
I know. Like,
be a man. Like, come talk to me. Why are you talking to my brother? Leave him alone. He has nothing to do. He doesn't even know. Like, he doesn't even. And my brother is not the type of personality that likes to, like, be, like, doesn't like to be talked about and stuff. So he's not, he wasn't interested in being this like guy in the middle that has to talk to me and tell me stuff. And he was feeling uncomfortable by my actions, but my actions. I wasn't going to stop because someone else felt uncomfortable. I told him, tell them to talk to me if they have a problem with me, leave him alone. Like he has nothing to do with this. Right. And yeah, I guess there's some downsides to that approach, but it is what it is. I mean, we all have our own, you know, ways of letting people know. So you came out publicly and you face a consequence. So there's no real undo button from that, is there?
Oh, no, apparently not. So that you had that experience with people approaching your brother, because I actually had the same thing. Like I had all these aunties back in South Africa who I haven't spoken to since God, I don't even know when. And instead of approaching me, they were abusing my mum, which was just so bizarre. Like, you know, you can just message me directly on Facebook. You don't need to go abuse my mum. Like, she doesn't have anything to do with this. But again, I think you're right in that they are cowards and
wanted to put pressure on someone that they knew they would be able to influence, because they probably knew that if they talked to you, that nothing would happen. But mm-hmm. they talk to your mom, then they can pressure your mom because your mom will be uncomfortable and then she'll pressure you. And like same thing happened with Abdullah Gondal when he came out in Canada. His parents are in Pakistan. They're getting all of this like harassment in Pakistan. And like he's like, just tell them you have nothing to do with it. Like what is you know what I mean? But they were trying to shut him down by proxy, because that works sometimes, that tactic. Parents did your parents say they were gonna not eat it ever again or anything like that?
No.
that's good because I've heard get to that point where, you know, sometimes parents will be like, I'm just gonna starve myself until you come back to Islam or something like that. And of course that's basically bullying, right? At this you know, it's I don't know if it's bullying or blackmail. It's
sort emotional of manipulation. Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you hear about examples like that from other ex-Muslims?
I mean, I had not met another ex-Muslim until this year. Like, when I say this is very new for me, this is all very new for me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But I did catch up with some ex-Muslims who live in my city. I found them and we went out for drinks. It all felt very clandestine and just I felt so bad. You know, there was this like hanging sense of guilt around me. How am I'm drinking alcohol with all these ex-Muslims? It's crazy. And I think there's a lot of diversity and variance in our backgrounds and where we come from and how we got to where we were. There were no two people at that table who had, you know, stories that were strikingly similar or that followed a certain path. It's just, it is so, so different. And like what you said before, personality plays such a big part in it. Like your parents, they were okay with it. And that is so awesome. And that's a reflection of them and how they connect with you and the world. And a lot of parents, maybe they've been through some traumatic stuff themselves. And so they react quite aggressively or violently and that sort of thing.
But yeah. You know, My parents, my dad was pretty much agnostic and my mom maybe a little bit too, because in Kenya, we had this, because we migrated from India to Kenya. Kenya is a very multicultural place. I don't know, South Africa, probably the same. So they had a lot of exposure to other ideas and beliefs, and there was Hinduism and Sikhism and Christianity, like a lot of Christians there. So I don't know if that's what it was, but that somehow they were a little bit more skeptical. My family is more, they're more like, like I told my mom as a Muslim, like, you should sell the house, this haram mortgage, right? And she was like, no, forget it, kid. I don't know what you're talking about, right? I'm like, no, it's haram. I'll show you the hadith. She's like, no, just forget it. It's not happening. And I'm glad she didn't listen to me, because at the time I was like, you know, full of high on iman, and I'm like trying to like, yeah, we have to get this halal mortgage that costs five times as much. Please, let's just sign up for that. And she's like, nope, not having it. I'm just gonna stick to the mortgage. We have the mortgage. That's it. End of story. So I'm lucky that they're a little bit agnostic. So maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's the more religious, you know, ones are the ones which are a little bit, you know, more take it worse, and the ones which are less religious, they're like, you know.
I don't know though. I think it's interesting for ex-Muslims and Muslims as well who are growing up in the West. Something that I have heard from a lot of people is that when their families move to this new, you know, secular haram country, that actually they became significantly more religious. And I think for my family that might actually be the case, because I look back on pictures in our family albums and I see my mum wearing a bathing suit, you know, like a full-on bathing suit, this married Muslim woman with children. But then when we left South Africa and we left, you know, that community and that family, and we moved to this strange Western country, the script started to really flip, and they started to become more religious, more strict. It kept sort of going down that path until it got to the point where they decided they were going to go on Hajj. And the people facilitating Hajj all the way over in New Zealand were nuts, like they were radicals. And so that contact and that process for my parents, I think, was quite a big turning point. When they got back from Mecca, it was like intense. Like, you know, there was this intensity in the house. There was a lot of arguments and fighting and shouting about what we should be doing and what a good Muslim looks like. So that was, it was a lot. But I think, yeah, living in this Western country surrounded by all, you know, these infidels, they were like, wow, we got to rein it in. We've got to really step our game if we want to raise some good Muslim children. And obviously that worked out just well for them, didn't it?
was this because of the Hajj, or was this because of being, like you said, it's like a subculture that's being threatened by this bigger, you know, culture on all sides?
I think it was a bit of both. But those Hajj organizers played a big part in it, I believe. You know, I only saw I saw the tip of the iceberg, basically, because I was still a child when that happened. But when I reflect back now, I can see that was the catalyst for things to start moving in quite a more, I don't want to say radical, but a very a lot more strict sort of structure. Yeah.
So you went for Hajj too then as a child?
No, oh no, I did not go. I was still in school. So my parents left me with our other crazy family, and that was a lovely time. But no, they went by themselves.
3 weeks, did they?
What was that?
They went for 3 weeks.
I think so, yeah. They were gone a long time. So they basically shipped in my auntie and uncle from another country to look after us while they were gone.
Yeah, I find that so sad too. One of my friends actually went for Hajj and left his little nursing baby for 3 weeks. And I was like, I can't believe you're doing this. Like, he's like, oh, this is my only chance to go for Hajj. And I'm like, yeah, but your child is still nursing. It's not even 2 years old yet. And, you know, is that really necessary to go right now? But I guess for whatever reason, it was a promoted time to do that right now. So they just went ahead and they went. And I, you know, now that you mention it, it's actually interesting that Hajj is a sort of religious, like it's almost like it could be a tipping point for religious extremism. I don't even know if I want to say extremism, but like indoctrination. So
absolutely, and I think it depends as well on who those people are that are organizing that Hajj for you, because they can be anyone, and sometimes, you know, they are actual freaks. Like, they can be weirdos who are out there to take thousands of dollars from you and tell you about all these awful things that you should apparently be doing with your life. It's quite, yeah, it just depends. Yeah. It depends, again, it comes back to that personality as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. So do you find that now that you're an ex-Muslim, like, how is, you know, now you must be depressed and sad and you know, now that you forgot Allah forgot you, so there's no more point to live anymore, I guess.
I know. Oh my God, I'm so depressed with my life, Abdullah. I'm so depressed with traveling the world. I'm so depressed with loving who I want to love and being in a long-term relationship, a healthy long-term relationship. I'm so depressed with owning my own house. Oh, I'm so depressed with having a dog that I wanted my whole life. It's just awful. Being an ex-Muslim, terrible, awful. Don't do it.
So all kidding aside, it sounds like you're actually doing quite well.
I hope so. I mean, I would say so. My life certainly didn't stop when I decided to become an ex-Muslim. If anything, I think that freedom to be able to think, do, and act the way I actually wanted to brought me a lot more happiness than when I was a Muslim and when I still was convincing myself that the shaitan was like corrupting my life and all this sort of stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm. Wow. I mean, I'm happy to hear that. So what would your advice be to people that are Muslims that are doubting Islam, but they're scared? Like,
I have two pieces of advice.
Yeah, like putting yourself in their shoes, and you know, they're scared the family is going to react, they're scared about what life is without God, you know, all of those things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The number one thing, the first thing I say to anyone who approaches me, you know, whether they're having doubts, whether they've already left Islam, is make your safety your number one priority. If you're, you know, 12 years old and you're still living with your family and you're going to be there for a while, is it the best idea to come out to them? Probably not. So safety, safety, safety. But then my second piece of advice is never stop questioning. Don't, you know, walk away from who you are or who you think you might be. Don't stop exploring that part of yourself because of fear. Put your safety first, but at the same time, plan and make steps to overcome that fear. Because from my point of view and in my opinion, I think that I became a lot happier when I admitted this to myself and when I went through this journey. So that's what I would say to them.
So it was worth, I mean, obviously it was worth it for you then to do this.
Oh, absolutely. I cannot tell you how worth it was. And, you know, I don't, when I first decided to start making these TikToks and doing all this sort of stuff, I didn't have any intention behind that. It was more sort of, this is how I'm feeling. This is what I want to express. And I'm just going to do what I feel like doing and make what I want to make. But then in time, I started to get these messages from people saying things like, you know, I'm so glad that I found your content and I didn't realize that there were other people like me out there. That's when I started to get this sense of passion and purpose and realize that, oh, sharing my story and using my voice actually makes a difference and can actually make a really positive impact on someone's life.
And so that's why I chose to keep going with it and keep doing what I'm doing.
Fascinating. That's a good segue to talk about what you do. So what do you do online? Like, what ex-Muslim stuff are you doing online?
You know, I think in a sense, I'm still kind of in that mindset of I'm doing whatever I feel like doing at the time. Sometimes I want to make a video laughing at something and it probably has no real purpose, but makes me laugh. So just going to do it. So I use TikTok as my, that was my original ex-Muslim platform, I suppose. There's not a lot of ex-Muslims on there. And so I have found that that platform is actually an excellent place to be reaching out, not just to ex-Muslim youth, but more so Muslim youth who might be questioning or have doubts or who might be inspired to think critically and outside of the box when they see content, you know, about Islam or about people doubting Islam and criticizing Islam. So I think there's a lot of value in that side of TikTok. Oh, there it is. Yeah, some of them are pretty cringy. I'm really sorry. And then the other side of it is I use Twitter. Again, it's more sharing my thoughts, saying whatever it is that I feel like have to or need to say at the time. And yeah, but I don't think I'm going to do things like set up a Patreon or anything like that. I just don't, I'm too busy. I don't care. I just want to connect with people, have a laugh sometimes. And yeah, that's kind of it. Oh, can't hear you. Is your mic off?
Yeah, sorry. Oh, thanks for telling me. I didn't know. Yeah, the Patreon thing I think happens when you do more and more, you start spending more and more time on the stuff, and then it becomes like, okay, I'm spending all of this money and all of these subscriptions and all of this like tools, and I want, yeah, you know, you want to hire people, and that's when it becomes a sort of, okay, I need some more money, I need help.
Yeah, now. Yeah.
But like when you're in the beginning stages, if you're just doing it for fun and you're doing it just on the side and it's not costing anything, then definitely then I guess there's no point at that point. But yeah, you're doing a great job. I do feel like the TikTok thing is an underutilized space. And I was like, funny thing is before I found out about you, I was sharing with some people in EXMNA, ex-Muslims in North America, that, hey, we need a presence. We ex-Muslims need a presence on TikTok because I'm seeing Islamic videos on there.
Oh, right? God, so many.
Yeah, like I only signed up like a month ago. And I was like, this was any Dawah guys on here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's some like diehard Muhammad Hijab Ali Dawah fans on there. And they're all about 12 years old. It's quite frustrating. There's so many of them.
The thing is, TikTok is, it's a unique platform. And to do it well, you can't just be like, yin alhamdulillah, and then just give a lecture. That doesn't work. You need to do it with music. Yep. It needs to be short, like 10, 15 seconds and all of that. And the cringy thing, like, trust me, if you see my original videos on YouTube, they are cringe. Like, they are embarrassing. Like, oh my God. Like what I'm doing now compared to back. And I'm sure, like, in a couple of years when I look back on this, with this reflection on my glasses, which I haven't figured out how to fix yet, with the green screen behind and all that, but it's so much better. Like, I'm, you know, we all go through that, so it gets better over time, right? But definitely, you know, I think you should keep doing what you're doing on that front, because we don't have enough people, and you're one of the only ones. I don't know, maybe there's others too, but I haven't found them yet. It's important. It's so important because, you know, like you were saying, I think you had a story about someone mentioned to you about the ex-Muslim label or something?
Someone messaged me recently. I don't know if this is what you're talking about, but he didn't know
the ex-Muslims existed or something.
Yeah, that's it. So he's now on Twitter. So I don't know if he's watching this, but if you are, hi. But he reached out to me on TikTok, and he sort of explained that, you know, before, really young guy, by the way, teenager, he explained that before he saw my content, he had no idea that this group of people existed, that there were other people like him out there in this world. And a few years ago, that was me. You know, I was in his situation, and I only got to the point where I am today because other ex-Muslims chose to speak up and use different platforms, share their voice, share their story. So in a way, I guess it's kind of like giving back, really, to people who might be in that same situation that I was once upon a time.
You know, for me, it was the opposite. I felt like I had to run, but I did.
Really?
I was promoting Islam. I had lightuponlight.com. I had 4 million, I don't know, 2 million downloads or something. Wow. I had Whisper Quran is not really as bad, I think, as Light Upon Light, because Light Upon Light, I had a lot of Salafi content. I even had some jihad articles on there. Like, it's just like, I was like, converting people to become more religious, like not converting people, but like making people in my life more religious around me. My younger brother became Sunni because of me, and then Salafi because of me. So I was like doing damage all over the place. I'm like making people, like I'm convincing people to worship a lot more. I had to like undo all of that nonsense, and I felt responsible for that. But for sure, like, you know, I want to give back, like I want to pass on, you know, from Hassan Radwan, the Masked Arab, and all of these guys that I looked up to. For you, it's Yasmin Muhammad, Sadia Hamid, and, you know, others. Why is it important to do this? Like, you know, like, to talk about these things? Like, don't you have a life? Don't you have other things to do in your life? Like you said, you know, you have a house, you have a dog, and like, why bother? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't have a life. Actually, being ex-Muslim is my only personality trait. I don't know if you knew that, Abdullah, but you really should by now. So can we just clarify? This is my only personality trait. This is all I'm able to do with my life. Fuck the rest of my three university degrees. I don't matter. But no, seriously, if people like you and I don't speak up about this, are we not just perpetuating the narrative that leaving Islam is the worst thing you can do, that no one should be doing it, that no one apparently is doing it? You know, because that's what I grew up believing. I grew up believing that, you know, that there were no ex-Muslim aunties and uncles. If someone left Islam, they were not part of a family. They were not even considered a human anymore, you know? And yeah, we have to change that. We have to shift that script and show people that ex-Muslims are just normal human beings trying to live their lives, and trying to inspire other people to be their true selves and to not be afraid and to embrace, you know, that freedom and find true happiness for themselves, whether that's as a Muslim, an ex-Muslim, or something else.
Well said. That's beautifully said. That'd be a good TikTok right there. Trust yourself, be yourself. And I don't have any personality. I'm just an ex-Muslim. Yeah. You know, actually, what do you think about the ex-Muslim label? I know some people don't like it because it's playing identity politics. Mm. What do you think about the ex-Muslim label?
Look, obviously the ex-Muslim label, we all know this, it's a very contentious tag at the moment, I guess. But I think at the same time, it's also a very important thing to be using, because just in that word itself, ex-Muslim, we're showing to the world that, one, we actually exist, that we can exist and that we can live lives and be happy and go ahead and do whatever we want with ourselves, you know. And it comes down to that mindset in Islam where it's kind of like tunnel vision, right? You can't see things that are going on around you on the other side. You have no concept of life outside of Islam. But when people come across people like you and I, they get some different insight. We inspire them to think critically and consider that perhaps, you know, there is actually a fulfilling life that you can live as an ex-Muslim. Or yeah, not, you can just be a loser with no other personality trait. There's also that, you know, whatever.
what do you say about, you know, I'm being the apologist here, the Muslim apologist. What do you say to people that say that you're a bigot, you're attacking Muslims, and you know, Islam is beloved, the Prophet is beloved? I'm trying to say it in a way that's they're saying it. You're a bigot, you attack Islam, you Islamophobe. Why are you talking about Islam? Our Prophet is most beloved to us, and, you know, more beloved than our mothers. Would you want me to insult your mother? What do you say to people that say that to you? Because it sounds like you've had people say that to you.
Oh, you know, I have people say that to me. Look, I don't understand why, no matter how many times I explain this or how many ways I try to approach this, people cannot comprehend the distinction between ideas and people. You and I are people. Islam, Christianity, Pastafarian, you know, all of that, they're ideas. They are sets of ideas. And so when people say things like you're insulting Islam, Islam doesn't have feelings. Islam, you know, isn't a human. It's a completely different concept. And so I try to make that distinction as clear as I possibly can, but it's very difficult, because I think people, before they even watch our content, they want to believe that we are bigots who don't like Muslims and who have all these negative things to say about Muslims. I challenge those people to find us ever saying something negative, unprovoked, about a Muslim, you know, because I don't think you're going to find it. because that's not what we do. That's not what we're about. In fact, a significant amount of ex-Muslims very openly advocate against anti-Muslim bigotry. Like, for example, what's happening in China. So many of us have spoken up about that, you know, and talked about how horrendous and what a massive breach of human rights that is. Is that bigotry? Because I think people might be a bit confused about what the word bigotry actually means, if that's the case.
Yeah, just want to highlight this comment before we go ahead. Aisha, you're inspiring. Your hair is bomb. Please keep doing what you do. Speak up for those who can't. Love a fellow female closeted ex-moose.
Oh, that just shows
you that, like, this is why we do what we do, because there's people in the closet that just don't have the opportunity. They don't have the situation yet, and maybe there's, you know, there's many other factors that we can't actually go into that stop them, right, from talking about this.
Absolutely, absolutely. I don't know if you saw that video of the girl from Iran the other day. It was kind of floating, and she was crying, and she was so upset. So I went and I found her on TikTok, and she was talking about, you know, how they have to use VPNs to even access platforms like this and that kind of thing. People don't have the ease of access that we have, or the safety privileges that we might have, you know. So that again comes into why it is so important for us to speak up and to commit blasphemy on behalf of all those people who can't do that themselves without putting their lives at risk.
You know, it's so refreshing and so helpful to everyone else that's in the closet when someone like you comes out with the real face and does this, because it's just it's so difficult. But as each person does it, it becomes easier and easier, because everyone will see, well, this person did it, and, you know, Aisha did it, and Abdullah did it, and he's fine, he's okay, and he's fucking blabbing his mouth all day about this stuff, and he's still fine. So I mean, I'm sure, and that's another distinction that's worth making. A lot of the risk in the activism or the movement comes from talking about Islam publicly. Being an ex-Muslim is not as dangerous in the West in as per actually talking about Islam. So some of the risks I'm facing, my blog, you know, being hacked and stuff like that, most ex-Muslims that don't talk about Islam, they'll be fine, because they can choose the level of risk. They can choose, okay, I'm going to tell my parents, I'm not going to tell my parents. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to tell these guys, and they're not going to know. No one's, I mean, of course, if some people know, there's always a risk that it'll get leaked. But I have many ex-Muslim friends, a lot of them in the 40s, believe it or not. Their parents don't know. They never told their parents. And I asked them, like, why not? They're like, oh, my parents are, like, in the 80s. They're going to die soon. And maybe they won't die soon. But I don't really want to upset the apple cut in this time of their lives. So they just pretend to be Muslim. And I'm like, okay, all the power to you if you can do that. I can't do that. I can't pretend to be Muslim. I mean, just bugs me, you know.
It's hard. That double life, believe me, I lived that for many, many years. It is one of the hardest things psychologically that I've ever had to put myself through, pretending to be a person that you're not for years, in the place that is supposed to be your home and your safe place. It's really, really challenging. Extremely.
Can you talk about that a bit more? Like, what happened? Like, what did you have to do? And is it because you were you already ex-Muslim at the time, or you was having doubts? Where were you in your apostasy?
So from the time that I started having doubts to the time that I left Islam, I was still living at home with my family through that whole process. And it got to a point where, you know, sometimes I would have these doubts and these questions, and I would raise them with my family, until it reached a tipping point, I guess, where I realized that it was becoming extremely inappropriate. It was causing a lot of issues. It was becoming quite a safety threat, actually. And so what I did was I just pretended, like your friend did. I pretended that I was Muslim. I made salah. I, you know, sat down to break my fast that I wasn't actually doing with my family, but I still had to get up every morning and, you know, in Ramadan and pretend to eat breakfast with them. It became so draining and so exhausting. And I don't think people talk enough about what the anxiety is like when you're living that fake life and putting on this persona to the world. It's a splitting of the mind, really. It's really psychologically damaging to a person.
And that's the thing that makes people want to just like come out. And you know, I constantly have to remind people, like, what you, I think you said it way better than I did. Safety, safety, safety. I think that's one of the most important things. I wanted to work on a guide. I've done like a couple of videos now on this topic. I wanted to work on a comprehensive guide to coming out as an ex-Muslim. And in the guide, I was going to mention that if it's not safe, don't do it. Like, yeah, we need more people coming out, but only if it's safe. We don't, like, we don't need more murders. Mm. If you're in Bangladesh and it's, or Pakistan, especially Pakistan right now, but we don't hear about some other countries. There's other countries where it's risky as well. Just don't do it. Like, there's no benefit to, like, to kill yourself over something and to ruin your life. And then there's a few people that they'll intentionally cause problems for themselves because they want to get, like, asylum. That happens. I've heard of cases like that. It's also not a good move. You should try to get out of the country by your hard work, not by, like, you know, requesting asylum. Of course, if you're stuck in a situation which you have no choice and now you need to get asylum, you should get asylum. But I'm just saying, don't put yourself into that situation intentionally. And then there's no, because it might not work out. Not everybody gets asylum. And you may end up shooting yourself in the leg and having a much worse living condition than if you would have just kept it to yourself, pretended to be Muslim. But it's tough, right? It's so tough to fake it when you know you don't believe any of this stuff, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. And especially for people living in those countries, like you said, they don't have those privileges. And that's where organizations like Free Hearts, Free Minds, or even Ex-Muslims of North America, these sorts of organizations, we need more of that. We need more of a globalized advocacy approach to actually find a safe pathway to get ex-Muslims, or even, you know, people like LGBT Muslims, people who are at risk because of Islam. We need a safe pathway to get them out of these oppressive, ridiculously barbaric countries into a place where they can actually just be themselves without being in danger.
Yeah, indeed. We have a long way to go in terms of changing these countries. The things are changing, but like there's also a lot of pushback. Like in Pakistan, I don't know if you saw the tweet from Prime Minister Imran Khan saying that I call on Facebook to ban Islamophobia. Like,
yeah, because it's just as bad as the fucking Holocaust, isn't it? Apparently.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, to be honest, this is a common talking point for Muslims. And I actually think they have a point that if you're going to, you have to be consistent with your ban, with your free speech laws. If you're going to allow cartoons of Muhammad, you have to allow mocking the Holocaust. As distasteful as it is, not mocking it, but I mean, mocking it too, I guess, but like denying it or whatever. Like, it's the same thing with like any sort of conspiracy nuts. Like, if you start making, the free speech thing is a tricky topic, but I do tend to kind of fall on the line of allow it because at least everyone knows about it rather than pushing it underground. So Ku Klux Klan, Nazism, all of these crazy ideologies, I want people to talk about it openly. I don't want them to hide it. I don't want to have secret meetings with it. We don't want that. We want it out in the open. We want to air the dirty laundry. We want everyone to see it. We want Ali Dawood to come on camera and say, I'm proud of capital punishment. I know some people, some of my friends are like trying to make, you know, trouble for these people and say that they should be arrested. I don't think they should be arrested. I mean, I believe in free speech. If you want to say that, as ridiculous as it sounds, if you're going to say that I should be killed under Islamic law, I'm allowing you to say that and say that all you want and go ahead. Of course, I have the right to say that's really shitty and that's barbaric and that's garbage or whatever. I can say something too, but you have a right to say that. Now, if you go and say, hey, Muslims, you should kill Abdullah. Okay, now you've crossed the line. Yeah. Now you're like, you know, targeting or hey, you guys, like another example, like this is where it gets tricky because sometimes people that talk about Islam are not actually talking about Islam, but the demonizing Muslims. I'm not going to mention the name of one popular fellow that writes books about jihad all the time. And all he does is demonize Muslims. Every single post on his blog is Muslim did this bad thing. Muslim did this bad thing. Muslim did this bad thing. And so now what happens is, sometimes it's connected to Islam. Sometimes it's loosely connected to Islam. Sometimes it's not connected to Islam. Muslim kills his wife. Okay, what does it have to do with Islam? Did he say Allahu Akbar before he killed it? No. Okay, so why are you connecting this to Islam? Because he's Muslim. Okay, so every single person that does something is motivated by Islam if they're Muslim?
Mm.
I mean, that's far-fetched. I mean, domestic violence is a universal problem in all cultures. So if you're going to say it's, if you're going to demonize, so when it becomes fear-mongering, then you've crossed the line. And I don't think it should be, there's a certain point where it becomes illegal, I think, where you're actually, because words have, like, effects, you know. They talked about this in I think it was in a Social Dilemma documentary on Netflix, but I heard the interview with Sam Harris and Tristan Harris, and he was saying that in Myanmar, it was on Facebook that these ideas were passed around that were demonizing the Rohingya Muslims, the stealing of jobs. It's always the same. They're stealing of jobs, the stealing of women. So the rapists, the illegal immigrants are taking our jobs, and then therefore they become demonized, and then people, and then of course they're being attacked now by, they were attacked by Buddhists, and everyone agrees that this is a genocide, just like China is doing to the Muslims there as well. So words, this is why I have a problem with people that I feel that sometimes we do cross the line, and thankfully, you know, the ex-Muslims that I work with, they don't do that. And if they do, I'll call them out. But we do have to be careful, right? We do have to be careful that we don't fall into bigotry and we don't actually start demonizing people. Because like you said, a problem is with Islam, not with Muslims. And of course, Muslims are sometimes a problem too. But then we condemn them for the actions, not, and we don't assume that everyone in that group is a monolith, right? Mm-hmm. You might look Muslim, because you come from a Muslim family, you have a Muslim name, but you're the furthest from Islam. And then there's your sister who, you know, she might be a believer and your mom might be a believer, but all of you guys are somehow connected to Islam. You can't assume that everyone in the same group is just guilty and they all like support. Of course, there are Muslims that support the massacre that happened, the beheading of Samuel Paty, that we've seen them. Either they'll say, you know, this, you guys, they'll use language that they'll say like, oh, this was not they agree with it, but you know, look what he did, kind of like victim blaming, right? Kind of like blaming the woman that's raped and saying, oh, look how she's dressing, kind of like that. Some of them will go even further and say, yeah, this is what you deserve. And then, you know, some of them are kind of like in the middle now and they don't know what to do. What do you say about all that? Like, that's just like all over the place. I just threw like a bombshell on you now.
I'm going to backpedal a little bit. So you talked about free speech and that line in free speech, right? And when what does it look like when you've crossed that line, and how do we know? So I think this line of free speech exists in such a gray area, like more shades of gray than you can possibly imagine right now. The way I think that I would conceptualize when we're crossing that line is I would apply, so in law we have what we call the principle of harm, the harm principle, right? And so when we can prove that there is a direct connection between what someone is saying and provoking or causing harm, so let's say, for example, someone makes a video about why you and I should be killed and how you should kill us or something, that's, you know, we can very clearly see and say that, okay, you've crossed over that line now, you're literally inciting murder. It's not difficult for us to ascertain that that's not good. That's really not a good thing to be doing. And so it's very, very tricky. And what you were saying as well about crossing that line into bigotry, when do ex-Muslims cross that line and what would that look like? I think it's when you're working in this ex-Muslim space, you need to be so careful about what you're putting out there and how you're putting it out there. Because quite often, whether we're intending to or not, you're going to start attracting these far right, you know, quite dangerous, very, very bigoted individuals who will hijack your narrative and use it for their own purposes and to suit their agenda and what they're trying to push. And so I think that's why it's very important for us to make that distinction clear, to speak out against all forms of bigotry, you know, no matter who it's against, and to be consistent in our values of basic human rights. So for example, something that's really concerning to me on TikTok is I've seen an ex-Muslim talk about how what China's doing is a good thing, you know, and that worries me. That makes me feel extremely scared for that person and for the people who are going to be affected by those words, and then the people who are going to cling on to and hijack that narrative to further that that picture of hatred towards Muslims. So we have to be so, so cautious about how we walk this line. And sometimes we make mistakes as well. We might put something out there with a very, a good intention, no intention of causing harm, but it can still be used against our original ideas of what that was about, you know? And so, again, it's about how you say it, how you're doing it, and just being consistent in your message and not picking and choosing who's entitled to have rights. That's just not how it works. Sorry, there's a plane flying over.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll just mute you for a second. You said it well, and I think we do all have a responsibility to make sure that what we're doing is not being used or hijacked by the wrong people. And how we do that is we just make it clear from time to time. Don't assume all Muslims are the same. All Muslims are different. Like, there's some commonalities, but there's huge differences. And so ask, what do you think about this? And someone was asking if you had any comments about the French beheading, since we're kind of on this topic.
In a way, I think a lot of us, myself included, were not particularly surprised when this happened. I think it's something that's been building up, especially in the context of France, where they've had so many people lose their lives to terrorism over the past decade. Like, it's been a growing issue in France for a long time now, and for other parts of Europe especially. And so it certainly wasn't a surprise. Obviously, I was disgusted and terrified and frightened to learn that this had happened in a Western country in the name of, you know, Allah and Muhammad and all this sort of stuff. And those people, so the way that we have to be careful with what we do and say in our narrative, I don't think people like that realize how their actions are actually impacting other Muslims as well. Like, you know, you're coming and calling us bigots, but then you go and chop someone's head off and we're the ones making Muslims look bad. It's like, dude, it's not quite so black and white. It's not so simple. It was horrific, and I was heartbroken when I learned what had happened, especially because I work in the education sector myself, and so it was very, very difficult for me to talk about that. I felt like I had no words to communicate how heartbroken I felt when I learned what had happened. So I still don't think I can really put it into words.
Yeah, it just shows you, when you have two groups of people, you have us that are, you know, humanists, and we are trying to go out of our way to make sure that, you know, we don't align ourselves with the more extreme elements, the far right. In my case, is also the Hindu right, which, you know, they were cheering us on, bash Islam, and they got mad when we started doing things about Hinduism. But, and then on the other hand, you have, you know, this unfortunately, like, I don't know what to call it, perverted Muslim mind that can't condemn these things outright because they're somehow connected to the theology, like killing apostates. Like, you know, when you push certain Muslims into a corner and you're like, well, your prophet did this, right? I mean, I think with the Aisha thing, that now they have different ways of getting out of it. They say she wasn't actually 9, she was 18. Mm-hmm. But they say that was allowed for that time where women grew up older, faster, somehow puberty quicker or something, and the people didn't live as long, even though Muhammad lived past 60 and Abu Bakr lived past 60. They all lived past 60, but somehow people didn't live as long back then, so they had to get married young. There's all sorts of excuses. But like, there's other things where if you kind of like corner them, you know, the prophet did this and he killed these people that did these things, they don't really have anything to say, and then they have to sort of like defend it. It's unfortunate, and that's what happens when you're stuck with a 1400-year-old religion. Sometimes there's other religions out there even older than that that has a lot of bad things in it. Muslims are just unfortunately stuck with these things, right?
And that's exactly why, isn't it? Why we have to speak specifically about the theology itself, about the scripture, about the explicitly violent verses that are very clearly connected to these very violent actions. For example, if it says in Islamic scripture to throw a homosexuals to throw gay people off cliffs or off great heights, and then we go and we see someone doing that, you know, and saying, I'm doing this for Allah or I'm doing this for Muhammad, are we supposed to then pretend that that has no connection whatsoever to scripture or that there's no link between these violent actions and Islam, at what point does it actually become Islam's fault? At what point does it become acceptable to say, this is a problem that we need to address? Because at the moment, I feel that we're only going to reach that point when significantly more people have lost their lives. And that's just, I mean, what are we doing? How is that helping anyone?
You know, that just, again, it goes back to the importance of what we're doing here. And like we are, I mean, just to toot our own horn a bit, as bad as it sounds, we are so essential what we're doing here, which is fighting Islam without being bigoted, you know, attacking the ideology at the ground, you know, being ex-Muslim and also living our lives. It's so important, because if you don't have that, then guess who gets the voice? It's going to be the far right. It's going to be these people that are saying, ban Muslims from coming to the country, and, you know, don't let, you know, like, basically assume all Muslims are the same, because if you're going to ban Muslims, you're assuming they're all guilty of something, basically, right?
Exactly.
Of course, unfortunately, there's a lot of Muslims with a lot of bad ideas, but I don't know if it's fair to just ban them just because they're Muslim. I think it has to be more nuanced than that. You got to look at, it's okay to have a, like, a values test, maybe, or, you know, that's something for policy experts to figure out, not for us. But what we can do is, we are fighting not just radicalization, we're fighting radicalization on both sides. We're fighting radicalization of Muslims and also of non-Muslims, because, you know, if we don't do this, then, well, what's going to happen? Islam is going to grow and grow and grow, and it's going to be, and these people, these far right people, they don't have the tools to dissect Islam. All they can do is, Muhammad is a pedophile, like, yo, you know, like, that's basically, they have a big hammer and they just hit Muslims with it, and it's not effective. Like, it's not, it doesn't usually convince anyone when you're just shouting at them like that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I know even in my town, there's been like people, so stupid, like protesting outside high schools about Islamic prayer in the school or something. And it's just like, it's like scary for the kids. They're seeing these people shouting, ban Sharia, ban. I mean, it's like, geez. I prayed in school when I was Muslim, and that wasn't Sharia. We're not establishing Sharia law. That was opt in. We decided whether we wanted to pray, prayed. I mean, I get that it's secular, and there's this, you know, there's some argument that can be made there, but like this, like, it's just, it wasn't, what they did didn't work. It didn't achieve any sort of real change. It just scared people. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you don't have a productive approach with a very clear-cut picture of what your end goal looks like, that is what you're going to end up doing. Stuff like protesting against Sharia outside of school and fucking traumatizing kids more than Islam is ever going to, my goodness. But again, it's that thin line to walk. It's about knowing what boundaries look like, walking that space with caution, and being very purposeful in the way you approach this. Not protesting outside of school and scaring children. That is kind of creepy, not going to lie.
Yeah. So let's switch a little bit gears. Before we end this, I want to talk about one more thing, which is belief in God. So do you believe in God anymore? Do you have any sort of spirituality in your life, anything like that?
I don't believe in God anymore. I'd label myself, I guess, as atheist, agnostic, in the sense that if I, you know, some giant man came out of the sky, told me he was God, and I got no idea where he's come from, maybe then I'd be a little convinced. But with the evidence that we have available to us today and the science that we have available to us in Islamic scripture, I'm not convinced, one, that there's an Allah, or two, that there's a God at all. Engaging with people's content like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, you know, those very prominent popular voices out there who speak about this kind of stuff, that hooked me in a little, and that got me down that line of thinking of is God actually real, let alone is Islam real, but is God himself, you know, is there any evidence to suggest that there is this higher power? And the more I looked into that, for me personally, the conclusion was that there's no evidence, that it didn't make sense. And then I guess that played into me leaving Islam too, because if you think God doesn't exist, well, kind of screwed in terms of believing in Islam. That's probably not going to work out very well for you.
Yeah. Did you find that, like, losing faith in God was traumatic in any way for you, or Islam in general? Like...
I did. I did, in the sense that you know, when you've been through traumatic religious experiences, something that comes and that stays with you even after you've left the religion and come to terms with who you are is that guilt, that religious guilt that can hang around you. I think a lot of us don't like to talk about this because it's something that people are going to froth over and talk about. Oh, look, it's proof that Allah exists. It's your conscience and whatever. Look, it's not your conscience. It's a trauma response. I've had times, for example, it happened this year where I went outside and the sun was setting and I was standing under a tree. And my mum and dad used to tell me growing up that if you stand under a tree during Maghrib time, that you're going to get like possessed by jinns or something like that. And every now and then when I'm standing outside in the sunset, I will get that fear. It's like a fear of holy shit, you know, what if it was all real and what if I'm wrong and I'm going to burn and blah, 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 and you start spiraling. That's trauma. That's what a trauma response looks like when you've been through something like leaving Islam, I think.
Mm-hmm. And how about the whole God belief, like just believe in God? Did you feel like alone, scared? Did you have any sort of trauma?
Cut out one more time.
Oh, just specifically about God. Did you have any trauma regarding losing faith in a higher being? And just the fact that, like, you know, there's no afterlife. I just to give you an example of what I mean, like one of my friends was like, oh, I don't know who's going to take care of my daughter when I die. Even though from my perspective, I never really understood that sort of thinking, because God doesn't take care of everyone anyways. A lot of people die and get sick, get cancer and get run over, like get murdered. Like, how is God taking care of anybody? He's not. Exactly. But anyways, for this person, he was thinking like that. Did you have any sort of like trauma from losing God? Like God specifically?
In terms of losing God, I mean, I don't know. I think more than it being a negative thing, it was much more of a freeing thing. Like a weight had been lifted off my shoulders and I don't need to force myself to think within the constraints of this little box that God has apparently laid out for me. There was definitely, again, coming back to that guilt and fear. Guilt and fear played a part in it because there was that question of, well, what if I'm wrong and I've just totally pissed this God off? He's going to, you know, shit on me in the afterlife. This isn't going to be great. That was scary. But in terms of not having a God to lean on, to rely on, to consult with, I didn't have that fear because he was never there for me in the first place. You know, when I prayed and reached out to him, he didn't respond. So it wasn't like I was losing some essential part of myself in that sense, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I empathize with you on that because this whole lack of having because Allah is a cosmic dictator. So you don't have this, I guess, evil monster watching over you, getting angry over you, not praying, not fasting, not wearing hijab, you're doing this, your shirt's a little bit too short, you didn't read enough Quran, you broke your fast, you know, all of these things. So your mortgage is haram, like you have a dog, like everything, every single thing in your life, your job is, you know, questionable or whatever. All of these things, they actually cause a lot of guilt and fear and, you know, you can't date and all that. So all of those things, I think they do make life much more miserable, and people don't want to admit that. They always think that with God life is better, but a lot of times the balance is weighed in the other way, where your life is actually much worse off. Like, you're not, it's, God is not, for some people God does kind of, you know what I think that like cultural Muslims have the best balance, where they don't have any of the Islamic sort of regulations, but they still have God, so they still pray to God and like, yeah, I got, like my mom, God helps me kind of thing. But she doesn't like care about any Islamic other law thing, right? Like, she doesn't care about mortgage or whatever. She might eat halal. I mean, she eats halal, but like in general, I think that's sort of the best balance. Whereas if you're like uber religious, the more religious you are, the more you're sacrificing for something that's never gonna come, right? So I mean,
I envy cultural Muslims because they still get to celebrate Eid and do all the fun parts that kind of come with Islam as well. But then here in Australia, so I live in quite an isolated city, so it's very tight-knit in terms of our Muslim community, right? And growing up, going to high school with these Muslim girls, a lot of them didn't wear hijab. You know, they would have sex with boys and kiss boys and do all these sorts of things that you weren't supposed to do as a Muslim. But when it came time to playing the morality higher ground, they would whip out the, you know, but I believe in Islam, so I'm better than such and such a person. And it's like, you believe in Islam, but you don't you're not following it. Like, you're not following any of the practices and teachings of it. You're just using it to pretend that you're better than others. So I don't know, cultural Muslims, it's an interesting mix of people in there, I think.
Yeah, it is. I never really understood cultural Muslims, to be honest, because I know, like, when I was Muslim, I was Muslim. Like, I did it. I believed in it. I don't get this, like, weird, I'm Muslim, but I don't care about praying thing or fasting or anything. Like, it doesn't make sense to me. If you're Muslim, then aren't you afraid of Allah's, like, punishment or something? Like, I never got that. And I think in some ways, cultural Muslims don't understand ex-Muslims for this very reason, because they don't do Islam. Mm. So they don't, they're like ex-Muslim without calling themselves ex-Muslim.
Exactly.
Because they believe, I mean, I shouldn't put in quotation marks. They do believe, but at the same time, they're not, I don't know. Like I said, I never got that. I was like, if you're going to believe in Islam, you believe in it, you pray, you do all that stuff because it's serious shit, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't believe, like, you know, pick one. Like, it's kind of having your cake and eat it too. I never got that.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know, when I was still Muslim, I think the way that I rationalized that to myself was, but Allah's inside my head and he knows what I'm thinking. And so even if I'm not, you know, if I didn't complete all my 5 prayers today, Allah still knows I'm a good person and that I have good intentions because he knows everything. So I don't need to worry. I'm not a bad person. And I think that's the mindset that kind of they get stuck in, you know, because he's everywhere. He knows us. We're great. It's fine.
Yeah. I guess that's one way to self-justify. Yeah, that makes sense. God knows I love God. God's in my heart, sort of thing.
Okay,
so just going to take a quick break and remind everyone that this is a new channel, Abdullah Samir Clips. Normally, podcast long interviews will not be on the Clips channel, but it'll be on the other channel. But just for now, until I get monetization back, I'm going to be doing most of my uploads on this channel. So if you're new here, please do join now. Please do subscribe. The link is below. If you're listening to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify, if you didn't know that I'm on there, do check out the podcast on there. It's much easier to listen to long-form interviews like this one on a podcast format. So do check that out. Unless you have YouTube Premium, of course, then you can listen on YouTube. But do check that out. And it's growing slowly, but surely it's growing. So feel free. It's for your convenience. Just makes it easier to listen to these interviews. And of course, there'll be clips coming and the best parts of the interviews are going to be uploaded once I have a bit of time. And I just want to say thank you to Aisha for coming and for doing this wonderful conversation, for sharing her, you know, her story. And, like, you know, it's a really brave thing to do, to come out, to talk about Islam, to talk about why you left Islam. There's always consequences, you know, and there's risks to one's career and risks to one's relationships with, you know, family members. There's a cost, right, in doing this. So do support Aisha. Check out her TikTok, check out her Twitter as well. And like she said, she's not doing this for money or anything like that, but we want to support her in the good stuff that she's doing. So Aisha, any final comments you want to make or anything you want to share to the world? Now is your chance.
Watch Abdullah Samir's podcast and follow him on Twitter and follow him on TikTok and YouTube and everywhere else that he exists, because he's amazing. And thank you so much for letting me come on your platform and share my story. I really appreciate it.
Hey, that was awesome. I'm always amazed when I offer the platform to someone and they're like, listen to me, listen to my stuff. I appreciate it. Thank you. So where do you go from here then? So you're living your life. Someone asked, it's up to you if you want to answer what you studied, your degrees. It's totally up to you if you want to talk about that. If not, like, what are your goals for the future, either personally or with the ex-Muslim thing, or, like, you know, what are your dreams or goals or aspirations for the future? Whatever you want to share that's, like, public.
So I plan to continue having being an ex-Muslim is my only personality trait. I just want to make that very clear. That is my intention, to continue doing that. Wow. In terms of where I'm going, I don't know. It's such a loaded question, isn't it? I have been, since joining this ex-Muslim realm, I've been thinking very seriously about focusing my PhD within this space. There's, you know, little to no research at all, no empirical evidence or anything about any of the issues we've discussed today. So I think that might be something I might look into doing probably next year.
Wow, impressive. Well, you know, like you're doing a great job in what you're doing, which is being a real human being and not just being an ex-Muslim. Like, you know, you're making a joke about that, but it's true though. Like a lot of people think that, you know, this is all we do, and even me, you know, despite all I do, I actually do have a life too. I have a full-time job, as you know, because I delayed this thing tonight because of that. And I have a family, I have a wife and kids, and so somehow I find time to do this. Sometimes it's at 12 o'clock at night, and sometimes it's when I have a day off or something like that, or on the weekends. But it's important to me, and you know, it's this work that we're doing, even if it's not a full-time thing, it's so important that you know we all contribute however we can. Your contribution is unique, and I think it's amazing. And I do hope more people will follow you into doing TikToks as well, and you know, of course, on Twitter as well. I do appreciate your candor and your respectful dialogue and the way you dialogue with people, right? And obviously, you're a very busy person. I can see that you're doing so much. So it's amazing that you find time to do this. And you know, thank you for coming and for showing your, you know, showing us your personality and talking about your personal life. It's again, it's not easy, and I appreciate you and thank you so much for coming on here.
No, thank you. Thank you so much. I've had an awesome time.
Okay. All right, everyone. It's been a lap, and we'll see you at the next show. Bye for now. And if you're listening to this on a podcast, please do leave a 5-star review or leave a comment, like a review on you know whatever platform you're using. That'll help get it up in the charts, and that would be most appreciated. Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.